Chapter 31. It's my war, goddammit. Nothing illustrates the power that Charlie Wilson was able to wield on behalf of the Afghans better than the story of a humiliating incident he was subjected to on one of his trips to Pakistan with Sweetums. The incident took place in 1986, at the end of a particularly satisfying tour in which he had been received as a conquering hero everywhere he went. As usual, he had flown into the Northwest Frontier Province to give blood at the IRC hospital in Peshawar, and then meet with the Mujahideen commanders who had gathered specially to see him. As usual, the Defense Intelligence Agency plane attached to the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad was assigned to fly him and his party to their various stops in Pakistan. At the end of the day, the plane was scheduled to fly him and Sweetums to Lahore for an official dinner being held in his honor. Moments before boarding the plane, everything collapsed. It turns out that the embassy's military attaché, an Air Force colonel, had taken it upon himself to scrutinize the rules, and discovered that civilians other than wives or relatives of congressmen were not cleared to fly on his military spy plane. The colonel had done his duty as he saw fit, and without hesitation ordered the pilots not to let Sweetums come aboard. It didn't matter to him that on previous trips Wilson's friends, Snowflake, Joanne, and even his belly dancer, had all flown on that very same plane. Nor did it concern the colonel that the congressman and his companion were scheduled to be the guests of honor in Lahore that evening, nor was it of interest to him that no commercial flights were available until the following day. The colonel, it appears, had no idea that he might be picking a dangerous fight. He seemed to believe that Wilson was little more than a braggart without any leverage. The Texan was, after all, an elected official, and the colonel had caught him red-handed, trying to appropriate one of the nation's precious spy planes to ferry a beauty queen about the Northwest Frontier Province. It was, as the attaché saw it, a clear abuse of power and hardly an issue Wilson would like to risk surfacing in public. One of Wilson's escorts had tried to warn the colonel that he was making a mistake. "If I were you, I'd interpret those regulations loosely, or else you guys are going to lose your airplane." But now it was too late. The colonel had phrased his cable to Washington in such a way that the Pentagon had no choice but to deny permission for Sweetums. It must be remembered that Charlie Wilson was a senior member of the subcommittee responsible for the Pentagon's annual budget. He had been around for over 2 decades and knew well how quickly the Pentagon was prepared to bend the rules to accommodate their congressional patrons. This colonel was trying to say that his precious $200,000 plane was too good for Sweetums, and that she would have to wait a day in Peshawar until the next scheduled flight left. Wilson says that for the first time in 20 years he lost his temper. "This was the first time I actually swore and shouted. I just went bugfuck." At one point, Wilson found himself screaming at the tough old U.S. ambassador, who was clearly trapped in a no-win situation. In exasperation, the congressman finally ordered the colonel to get the president of Pakistan on the phone. Wilson had never asked Zia for a personal favor before, and the Muslim dictator immediately understood the gravity of the situation. Without hesitating, he told his friend Charlie that his personal plane was on its way to rescue Sweetums. That afternoon, as Wilson prepared to board Pakistan's equivalent of Air Force One, he told the offending officer, "This is not the end of this story, Colonel." Just to make sure the colonel understood whom he had picked a fight with, Wilson issued a humiliating order that the colonel was not in a position to refuse. The DIA plane was not to return to Islamabad, where the colonel and the pilots had been counting on attending an office picnic. Instead, the plane was to fly parallel to Zia's plane, with Charlie's personal baggage and poor Colonel Rooney, Wilson's military aide, along as the official cargo. Stepping aboard the plane, an awkward Rooney had told the furious pilots, "I'm just a little pissant on the crossroads of life. I had nothing to do with it." That didn't calm them down a bit. Enraged, they proceeded to warn Rooney that the Defense Department was going to get Wilson for this, and that perhaps they wouldn't allow Sweetums's bag to be put on the plane. Rooney replied, "Don't even touch that one. It's absolutely foolish." Zia had congratulated Charlie on his chivalry, but Wilson was now hell-bent on revenge. Back in Washington, he addressed his defense appropriations colleagues in the room under the Great Dome. "Gentlemen, the honor of the co-equal branch of government has been challenged. They have insulted the Committee on Appropriations, they have insulted me, and they have insulted my true love, Sweetums. I want you to give me revenge." Everyone on appropriations understood that this was a petty, if not reckless, act of revenge that Wilson was calling for. But they also knew that it was something they had to do for their colleague. It was a professional courtesy, in effect. And lurking behind their vote to support their colleague was the recognition that it was not healthy to allow a lowly colonel to insult a member of Defense Appropriations. For all these reasons, the subcommittee moved to remind the Pentagon once and for all how to regard a member of Defense Appropriations. Them that has the gold makes the rules. Ultimately, the whole sorry story surfaced in a front-page exposé in the New York Times. It turns out that by order of Congress, the offending DIA plane, along with one more for good measure, was permanently removed from the military spy agency's fleet. And just to make sure the Pentagon got the message loud and clear, the two planes were reassigned to duty with the Texas Air National Guard. Typically, Wilson seemed not in the least concerned about the resulting scandal and controversy. For a time, it seemed to overshadow all of the positive things Wilson had achieved in the region. In spite of that, he wore the attention almost proudly. For over 3 years, Wilson had been the real magic bullet of the Afghan War, all but invisibly hurtling through the entrails of the U.S. government. For the first time, he had publicly demonstrated his willingness to bite, and he knew the story would only add to the legend that it was suicidal for any American bureaucrat to get in the way of Congressman Charlie Wilson and his Afghan obsession. For Pakistan's President Zia, it had been a pleasure to be able to help his friend and the great patron of the jihad. But on Wilson's next trip to Pakistan, when once again he became troublesome to another military man, Zia found himself in a very different frame of mind, determined to do everything in his power to prevent his all-important ally from getting his way. Brigadier Mohammad Yousaf went to bed on the night of November 15, 1986, with the certain belief that his work would earn him a place in paradise. The big barrel-chested, bug-eyed fundamentalist was then in his second year directing the ISI's super-secret Afghan cell. The excitement that swept over the CIA's Afghan task force once the tide began to turn that year was nothing compared to how this Muslim warrior felt. He was in operational command of the biggest and greatest of all modern jihads, and for the first time, he was convinced the Mujahideen were going to win. Brigadier Yousaf distributed the weapons, ruled on special operations, coordinated training, controlled the C-4 explosives and the Stingers, and passed on the satellite targeting studies. His officers were in radio contact with the Mujahideen commanders throughout the war zone. He even had teams of ISI soldiers dressed as Afghans operating alongside the Mujahideen or conducting their own special operations. Yousaf was at the very heart of everything, and more often than not he had been a royal pain in the ass for the Americans. The brigadier had not forgotten the insult of being taken blindfolded to the agency sabotage school. He had responded with his own petty revenge, only occasionally allowing the CIA to visit the training camps. It was a great concession when he let in the Near East Division Deputy Chief Tom Twetton, but only at night and in the clothes of the Mujahideen. Yousaf even founded a badge of honor that after 22 requests, he still had not given his home phone number to the two station chiefs who had asked for it. The CIA was a necessary evil, but he was quite determined to keep it at arm's length.